Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I'm Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages, and we offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets on our web pages. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club's website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange color type, but if you would like a simple URL, you can type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com, and that'll bring you to our puzzle page. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. And we also have an EchoLink node available for use. Just point your EchoLink application to the node kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month. And all of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the technical net or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Roy. Looking forward to a good net tonight. And I'm getting those weird beeps on the radio, and I hope it's not me because I got... You know, I have my brand new microphone. The clip is good and secure. So I don't know if it could be some other problem with my radio or it has nothing to do with me. Back to you.
Okay, we will see what we will see. So far, no strange little beeps, buzz, or boops. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month. So if people out there have any questions or comments or topics for discussion, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign.
Yeah, this is Joe, November 2, Delta Echo Juliet.
Joe recognized. Good evening, Joe. I saw you on the Echo Link. It's nice to see you. Let's see. Anyone else want to put their name on the list before we get down to the questions? Hit that push to talk button and give us your first name and your call sign. Very well. It seems like you're first and only at this point, Joe. I'm sure as time goes on, there'll be other people with other questions. So what's your question or your comment for tonight, Joe?
First of all, I set my alarm, so I remembered it. I usually remember about 9 o'clock my time, which is midnight your time, which is a tad too late, so I'm glad with that. The only thing I could think of to ask you is I have an Ameritron AL811 amplifier, 3-tube, and I use it with my Kenwood hybrid, and... I was tuning up a couple of weeks ago. I tune up the radio, and then I amplifier, which has the 50 ohm whatever circuitry there, without it online, and then I'll tune up the amplifier, and then I'm good to go. So I did that, and I usually tune up into my antenna because it's pretty resonant on 20 meters, the area resonant. So I there's nobody on the channel and. On the frequency, and I tune up the radio into it, then I tune up the amplifier into it. And then I switched the ampli- I switched to my dummy load because I just wanted to verify my, you know, that my mic gain was properly set. And I heard a little fizzle, a noise, or what, I don't know what you call it. It wasn't a pop or anything. And then the amp won't key anymore. So power's on, the meters work, but, and I can't, question is, I can't find online any place to get like a flow chart to start try to diagnose the problem. I made sure it was dead, no current in there, no amps hidden away, unplugged it, discharged everything, waited a while. And everything looks perfect. Everything looks pristine. So I don't know where online to find like a flow chart to start diagnosing problems with it. Do you have any direction you could point me in there, Roy? Back to you.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that that your linear died on you. What you're probably looking for is a service manual. So the best bet I would suggest is Googling that model and service manual and see what happens. If you can't find anything, you can contact the manufacturer. The primary manufacturer of those that brand of linear amplifiers is MFJ. I would be willing to bet if you Google service manual, you'll find a bunch. Obviously, the first thing I would suggest is if nothing goes on, if you turn it on and nothing lights up, nothing heats up, the first thing you want to check is the fuse, obviously. Check to see if there's more than one. Sometimes there's a thermal fuse as a safety feature. So make sure that you know where all your fuses are and make sure that they're all working. Then, again, if everything's gone out, if the tubes are all dark, my best guess would be that it was a tube failure of some kind. In the old days, tube testers were great. They were on almost every other block. Now you got more problems. You pretty much have to kind of have replacement parts available, swap them out, and see if it works. I know of some old-timers who bought up all the vacuum tube testers. They're few and far between.
Roger, Roy. Everything works. It powers up. The fan comes on. The lights come on. The meters work. The HV meter works. The tubes are, you know, glowing like a little bit. Like, you know, they're lit up. They don't really glow. It's just the heaters are on. They're lit up. It's just when I key the mic, nothing happens. I put in operate, and the red light doesn't come on. I don't hear the relay keying. After I keyed when I went to talk into it, and I keyed it, and I heard a little fizzling noise or something, like not really a poof even, but it wasn't a pop or a bang. And after that, it doesn't key or anything, and the red light doesn't come on saying, you know, to operate there. So it's something with the relay, I'm assuming. But I'm going to check MFJ and see if they have a service manual. I think I Googled service manual, and all I saw was operation manuals. And I found a schematic that doesn't help me out at all. More like a box diagram I need or something like that. But okay, back to you, Roy.
Okay, I mean, sometimes they keep service manuals a little bit closer to their vests. You know, you can contact them and ask them. I would still kind of try extensively Googling. Look for a forum. Look for a group of people who are deeply into this model of linear amplifier. If you search the internet hard enough, eventually you will find a Reddit or a .io forum, some group of people who have looked deeply into this particular model because it's very, very popular. And I'm sure that they can give you a lot of insight by just describing it as you just did. It could be the relay, or, you know, unfortunately, there's a whole bunch of failure points. Even if assuming that the tube itself, well, the fact that it heats up means that the heater element is working, but there are other parts of the tube that can fail. Occasionally, RF chokes are used for these things. They can burn out and leave you an open circuit, and so it would kind of give you similar type of situations. But again, I talked to MFJ, and I certainly would Google it a little bit and see if you could find a Reddit site or a forum and ask them. In the good old days, they were guys who repaired everything. They're few and far between these days, unfortunately.
Roy, that's a great idea. I'm in a group, an I.O. forum on for the Kenwood hybrids, and there's a lot of knowledgeable people out there, and if I ever have a problem, I throw it up there, and the guys have the answer within like an hour or two. I'm getting an email back. So I didn't even think of that. That's a genius. I'm going to be Googling tonight and check that out. Thanks. That's great advice. Thank you very much. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. I wish you luck with it. Like I said before, if you can't find a forum on the .io site, try Reddit. Sometimes the guys there answering questions are not the most polite people in the world. It's a hit or miss. But that's another good source for general information. If you dig down deep enough, you might find a subreddit that's all about your particular linear amplifier. But I wish you luck with it, Joe. I know what it feels like to have something go down on you. My Flex radio failed. It's more of a computer than a radio, so of course the fans failed. And without the fans cooling, the field programmable gate arrays that make it all work, it doesn't boot. I had to send it back to Austin, and unfortunately, they're so backed up, it's been sitting on a shelf there for 2 weeks, and they haven't even had a chance to look at it yet. So I feel for you.
Sorry about your Flex radio there. That's not good. I feel for you there, especially something as awesome and as expensive as a Flex radio. And the only good thing that came out of this is I got this amp when I was in Brooklyn because I needed an amp to get out of Brooklyn with all the above wires and stuff, and I only had a two-story house, and the wires everywhere around, it was like a Faraday cage in Brooklyn, so I needed an amp to get out of Brooklyn. And so I just automatically used it out here. I found out I reached just as far as I used to reach with the amp, without the amp. So that was the only good consolation of it, is that I realized I don't need the amp out here to be able to talk to people, in other parts of the country here on 20 meters. So that's the other good thing. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the good thing about wide open spaces. You can get away with lower power. And, that's why a lot of people aren't that thrilled with using linears. They like to go barefoot, as they call it. And if you're in places where you're not going to go, you'd be banging into all kinds of large steel-based buildings, you can get away with it a lot more. So I'm glad that you don't need the linear amplifier. I mean, when you need it, it's, hopefully once you fix it, it'll be there. You can turn it on. You can turn it off. I never used my linear more than about 500 watts. It seemed to suffice. If I made it any stronger, I felt that probably I was being heard by people I couldn't hear back. So it was a loss that way. So good luck, and thanks for participating tonight.
And I'll hang out and see if any other interesting topics come up. So I'll be standing by listening if you need me. 73.
Okie doke, very good. Once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, and we're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month, and tonight's the night. So if there's anyone out there with either questions or comments to be made, please hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
This is Alpha Charlie 2 Zulu Victor checking in. This is William.
Yes, William, good to have you aboard. I also see you on my EchoLink window, so I knew you were out there. Any questions or comments for tonight, William?
I got a lot of questions. I don't know how many have to do with ham radio. I'm right now, I'm trying to get something to work with this video, and it's not working for me, so I'm kind of distracted a little bit. But it's great to hear you guys chat about the radios and stuff like that. If I was going to ask you a question, I'd ask you, what do you think about this latest Windows operating system?
Which one are you talking about? There's a lot of people still have 7. A few people have 8. I think most people have 10, and I'm on 11 right now. There's going to be a new update for 11 in about, I think, a week or two, and it rolls out slowly, so not everyone's going to be offered it. I find that Windows 11 is okay. I think 10 was better. I don't know why they broke the taskbar and a bunch of other things when they moved to 11. Every update, they promised to put more of the Windows 10 taskbar back into 11. So, I don't know what to tell you. It's passable, but if I probably had it to do all over again, I would have probably stuck to 10 for another year or so until they figured out how to really make 11 go. But by that time, they'll probably be pushing 12.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I have 10 here, and I don't really see any need to do any upgrading, even though it wants me to do it, and they bother me about it all the time. So I'm not that much of a Windows guy, and so I don't know if 11 was going to be better, but it seems like they just threw more features into it that just use up more processing power, and you don't actually get to use your computer as much. It's just too much razzle-dazzle.
Well, I mean, the magic word today is artificial intelligence. So the update for the next version of 11 is going to include more artificial intelligence. They already have it in the Edge browser. They're going to incorporate it, I think, into the taskbar so that rather than do the simple search feature on the taskbar that some people enable, you'll be able to talk to an artificial intelligence on the taskbar. As I mentioned before, I wouldn't aggressively recommend going to 11 if there are versions of 10 that your computer wants you to update to. It might be useful. Sometimes these include, in addition to kind of garbageware, they also sometimes include security fixes. So you don't necessarily want to have known security flaws still on your machine. So if you ever kind of look into the internet, you're being pinged every second by some dubious servers all over the world trying to find if they can somehow get into one of your ports. And it's a never-ending contest. So, again, if you're missing some Windows 10 updates, you probably should update them to the latest, greatest version of 10. But I see no benefit in going to 11 at this time.
Yeah, Roy, thanks for that. You know, I think if I do 11, I would get a whole new Surface or something like that had it preloaded on it. I wouldn't deal with having to even upgrade what I have, because it seems like that would be just way too difficult, upgrading things and then hoping my software would still run. It just seems like that was a nightmare and a half. Do you know how long they're going to keep supporting 10?
Well, if it's like they did it in the past, probably easily 4 or 5 more years. Because, you know, it was only a couple of years ago that they simply said, look, we're not going to support 7 anymore. So you're good for a few more years, and probably that's a good idea. In addition, what I didn't mention is Windows 11 is kind of built on a security chip that is not very old, about maybe 6 years old. So if you got a 10-year-old computer, chances are you don't have the Mark II security chip that Windows 11 requires to install itself. So under those circumstances, and I think Microsoft offers software that just kind of looks into your system and tells you whether your system is capable of upgrading to 11 or not, non-destructively. So it's not like if you run it, it will decide that to install 11. It just assesses it and says whether or not you can upgrade it to 11. So if you're curious, you can look that up someplace. But the security chip and other aspects that are required means that aging computers right now, unless they change something, aren't even able to be updated from 10 to 11. So it's a good idea. Stick with 10. When you get a shiny new computer, it'll probably come out of the box 11 or 12, depending upon when you buy it.
Yeah, okay, that sounds great. Yeah, I'm basically going to just remain just with what I've got here and go out and buy a new, start saving my money and see what they come up with, because it seems like there would be, I'm sure my processor is too old, and even if I did load it up, it would just drone out really slowly. So Anyway, I'm having all these problems with these computers because the Macintosh is the same way as Windows, and I'm thinking that I need to get a new Mac computer as well because all of mine are old, and you know, with the internet keep changing all the time, I'm not so sure they're going to keep up with the security updates of Mojave, and so they keep switching it faster than I want to buy computers. Anyway, that's my sob story. Thanks for the TechNet discussion. I think I got to go upstairs and move around upstairs, so I'll check in back with you later.
Okay, very good, William. Macintosh is not Windows. It's a GUI. It's a graphic user interface. It's a windowed environment, but it's based on Linux, or actually BSD Unix is the original core, and then they built the GUI over it. So it's a different kernel. It's a little stronger than the kernel that Microsoft went with. But, you know, computers are computers. None of them are simple and easy, and occasionally they decide to act out. But, okay, we'll talk to you a little later then, William.
And to DEJ comment?
Yes, Joe.
William goes, hopefully I catch him. I have Windows 10 on my laptop and on my gaming computer, and if when you hit the go into settings and you hit like check for updates, in the screen where you check for updates to the right, it'll automatically tell you if you're eligible for Windows 11 because they're pushing it heavy. And even though they're brand new computers, my laptop can can update to Windows 11, but I won't. I kept Windows 7 till I absolutely it wouldn't work till they wouldn't support it anymore. Because if I find one that works well, I want to keep it. So I'm not getting rid of 10 for now. And my gaming computer, because games don't use hyper-threading technology, it's a very advanced chip, but it doesn't have hyper-threading, so it's not eligible for a Windows 11 upgrade. So thank goodness for that, because they're not bugging me every time I open it up to download it. I have to make sure they don't trick me in downloading it accidentally, like on my laptop. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Joe. I'm not quite sure, though. I think pretty much all of the Intel and the AMDs are hyper-threaded. The problem with computers and why your desktop probably isn't eligible for Windows 11 is, as I mentioned earlier, there's a security ROM that's on the motherboard, and it requires the second generation. And older computers have the first generation. So if they do a kind of inspection of the computer and they can't find the second revision of the security chip, that disqualifies it. I think that's what's doing it. I think that all of the CPUs for the last 20 years have had some degree of hyper-threading.
I built the gaming computer, so it's got a fairly new motherboard. It's only like it's not even 2 years old, and the chip is an i5, Intel i5, and they they're for the gaming. And if you can look up the specs on it, I believe the ones that are made mainly for gaming, like top of line gaming ones, they don't have. My understanding was that they didn't have the hyper threading technology, so I assumed that's why that one wasn't. Approve why Windows 11 won't work, but it could be what you said. I'm out of curiosity, I'll eventually figure that answer, look into that and find out for sure. Not that I doubt you, but back to you, Roy.
Yeah, if you have some free time, look up, I forget what the hell the thing is called. It's vaguely like Secure ROM, but it's probably something ever so slightly different. And there's two generations. There's the first one, and there's the second one that they brought out about 5 years ago. It sort of depends upon when the motherboard was originally made. If the motherboard, was kind of elderly when you bought it, it might have the older security chip. But you're not missing anything. Like I said, I upgraded just to make life simple. It kind of screwed up the taskbar a lot. There was a lot more functionality to Windows 10's taskbar than Windows 11. And although it's supposed to be a little bit more secure, I have no way of judging it. It didn't hurt me too much, but it didn't really benefit me any. And the artificial intelligence add-ons that they keep on piling up, probably, as William mentioned, is a bit more bloatware than is necessary. But time will tell, and like I said before, before you know it, a blink of the eye, and they'll be pushing a 12. And if you remember, when they came out with Windows 10, they kind of promised that they were going to keep it at 10 for the rest of eternity, almost.
I don't believe anything Windows says. They come up with a good operating system, and the next couple of crap after that, then they come up with another good one. Windows 7 was fantastic, and I hated to get rid of it, but to the point where they weren't servicing anymore, they weren't supporting it, and it was just too much of a risk to use it. When I finally went to 10, and I know the motherboard of my gaming card, I'm going to try to look and see if I can find that, if that is in any of the specs in the BIOS or anything, because the motherboard I bought was like the top of the line they had, less than 2 years ago, and the newest version of it. I think it might be, I can't remember which brand it was, but this is good, something to do with my spare time. I could look into that now. All right, thanks, Roy. Back to you.
Okay, very good. The only thing worse than, 7 was one of the best ones. I mean, there's very few far between. XP was very good, and then there was a run on crappy ones. 7 was very good. 8 was abysmal. Then they had a 8.1, which was abysmal. 10 was sufferable, so I tried 8, and I gave it a week. And then I rolled it back to 7, and then they announced 8.1, and I looked at it, and I said, nah. Finally, with 10, I said, okay, and I moved on to 10. From 10, I moved on to 11, but I took a complete pass on 8 and 8.1.
Roger. I picked up a Surface a long time ago, the Surface tablet, to use for work, but just to keep at work, not for work, just so I have something at work and leave it on my desk, an expensive thing, but it had 8 on it, and it was the biggest disaster in the world. And unfortunately, when I finally had to convert to 10, the biggest problem is it takes you a couple of months just to figure out how to do everything you did in an instant in Windows 7, because they always change. And same thing with 7 from XP, you have to learn how to change everything's changed how you do something. So something that you did intuitively, you have to relearn. So that's the biggest thing I hate about upgrading their operating systems. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, AC2GS. They have this really bad habit of rearranging things. They'll have the same stuff. They'll put them in different places. You have to figure out where they've hidden them. It could be a major pain in the backside. I use third-party software that brings a lot of the graphics interface back to about Windows 7. So I have a little bit less technical shock by using it. Of course, it costs money, but what the hell. I do that with the start menu. So my start menu looks very reminiscent of Windows 7, even though it's operating on Windows 11. But yeah, they always have to tweak stuff. I don't quite understand why.
Maybe just to keep the mystery going with people that kind of know what they're doing around an operating system. Over.
Probably just to rationalize why they're being paid. There's an interesting guy who has a YouTube channel who apparently was working in Microsoft way back in the early days of Windows. I mean, I'm talking Windows at least 3, probably 1. And, he comes on and he says, I'm the guy who gave you this window. I'm the guy who gave you that window. So, all these little windows that we open up to configure things, he was the guy supposedly who originally wrote it. So he has some interesting YouTubes. I forget his name, unfortunately.
I'll have to, keep an eye out for that. YouTube's fantastic. If there's anything around the house you need to fix, YouTube will tell you how to do it. Back to you.
Yeah, you do have to be cautious because every so often you'll find some guy who's just making stuff up. For some odd reason, I find that more common with amateur radio. Of all the amateur radio YouTubes I've seen, at least one-third of them have nonsense embedded in them. Most non-amateur radio, usually three-quarters of them are decent. I particularly remember there was a guy whose primary reason for having a YouTube was to discuss auto repair, and for some reason he did a special on Hall effect transistors, I guess because Hall effect transistors are embedded in some cars, and got the theory completely wrong, utterly, totally. Just, I don't know where the hell he came up with it, maybe in a nightmare. So you got to watch out for the occasional clunkers, and there's more than a few. You know, there's this guy, Ask Dave, that gives me a migraine every time I mistakenly listen to one of his videos. Because there's always a couple of faux pas in them.
Yeah, I've definitely done a lot of YouTube videos on ham radio, and I found, yeah, maybe about a third of them good, and maybe, I mean, two-thirds of them good and one-third by raving lunatics. Back to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I understand. There's no real gatekeeper, and a lot of times, especially on 75 meters, you bump into similar type of guys. Some of them are incredibly knowledgeable, and others are raving lunatics. So, and unfortunately, the raving lunatics have no way of knowing that they're raving lunatics. So they come on with as much verve and enthusiasm as the guys who know what they're talking about. So that's why I keep telling people you got to get a well-calibrated BS meter for these situations. You can kind of suss out the guys who are just making it up as they go along.
And I credit about half of the raving lunatics to the guys that want to convert, you know, ham radios to 11 meter and have it like blowing smoke out the vents while they're transmitting. You know, that mentality to some of these people. So half the raving lunatics, I think, come from that school of thought. Over.
Well, yeah. I mean, the CBers, it goes without saying that they have a lot of enthusiasm, not a great deal of technical know-how generally. And also, they tend to, unfortunately, like to cut corners. I don't know if you remember, back in the bad old days on the 10-meter net, we had a CBer down in Coney Island who had must have been the dirtiest linear amplifier that was ever made, because he had these parasitic oscillations that went all the way on to 28.380 on 10 meters with us. And so we would have to listen to some idiot calling himself Trinitron. I don't remember if it was Trinitron 17 or Trinitron and some number. So, yeah, they're a little shaky. I would probably not listen much to a guy who's kind of CB enthusiast type. But, you know, even some amateur radio operators get some things wrong. It's not particularly their fault. They're not doing it consciously. It's a lot of facts are kind of passed hand to hand, and sometimes it's the wrong thing, and sometimes it gets lost in the translation. So you always have to be a little wary of where the source material is coming from. You know, in the good old days, gatekeepers were publishers. You know, you couldn't have some guy just make up stuff and write a book. Nowadays, you could write all the books that you want. Someone pointed out a self-published book about amateur radio that looked like it was written by a very, very early, very bad AI program, because it was almost gibberish. It was just random words stuck together. So you always got to know your source.
And I noticed that a lot of the good people that have bad information, like you said, it seems like because I'm mostly researching or looking for information about the older radios, the hybrids, the tube radios and stuff, because I find that fascinating and I enjoy it. And a lot of the misinformation comes from bad, poorly translated manuals from Kenwood and stuff. and that the instructions are not very clear and people are misinterpreting how, say, to tune it up or anything like that. So a good part of the errors with the old stuff comes, like I said, handed down word for mouth because of bad, unclear manuals or bad translation and things like that. The Kenwoods are notorious for having unbelievably bad errors on their schematics. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even look at a schematic that came from Kenwood. I'd have to, you know, find somebody that knows their stuff, a guy that repairs them, and get a schematic from them. So that's part of the thing I noticed there. That the good guys that are genuinely conscientious, when they're wrong, it's because of that. I noticed mainly with the old stuff. Back to you.
AC2GS. Yeah, it's not only the errors that they print things with errors. A lot of these manufacturers, especially in the old days, would modify the circuit design, and they would change the boards. They would change the connections, but they wouldn't indicate it any place. So, you know, everything would be a Model 12B, but, you know, some 12Bs were different than other Model 12Bs. So that was a serious problem that a lot of old radios had for decades.
Well, I wasn't aware of that. That makes it even scarier. Back to you.
Well, what can you do? I mean, these things were kind of written as an afterthought. They were written because they had to, and they were written for the repair people, not the consumers. Engineers are not the greatest writers in the world. I'm sure there's a few that are wonderful, but and now they're far worse because, you know, especially the latest, greatest, least expensive radios you can get are Chinese. And if you think that manuals written by engineers in the 60s and 70s were bad, just read anything in what's called Chinglish, and it'll just give you a migraine.
You're making me laugh. People are going to think I'm nuts here because I got the headphones on, and I'm just bursting out laughing for apparently no reason. Back to you.
Okay, well, you know, I mean, they should be used to that. I mean, that's what we do. We stick headphones, at least I stick headphones, and so that people passing by just hear me talking to myself.
Well, nothing wrong with laughing. You're making me laugh out loud. I'm thinking how comical it must appear to anybody else in the house here. Back to you.
Okay. Very good. Well, I'm glad I amuse. When I do the intro of Limarck's TechNet, I talk about informing, educating, and entertaining. So I'm glad I'm entertaining tonight. Let's see. Any other things happening to you that you want to talk about here?
We bit the bullet and decided we had to get rid of the sunken living room. These houses were designed like the Mary Tyler Moore Show or Dick Van Dyke Show with a sunken living room, and it was just going to kill me, especially as I get older. So, but it's a lot of people don't get rid of them because it's such a big job. Because you not only got to rip up the old floor, you got to replace the whole floor of the living room because, you know, you can't match it up when you got to get the cement poured in. And then out here, everything's kind of like all open, so it's one whole floor. So as you keep going, you wind up, you know, putting a whole level of floor in your house. And then when you start that, well, since I'm ripping the floor out, I might as well take this wall down that I want to. So it's turning into this gigantic renovation here. But, you know, it's going to look good, and it's going to keep the XYL very, very happy. But I'm dealing with that now. Me and the dogs. That's about it. Over.
Ah, very good. Well, I'm sure you'll enjoy it. You know, a nice level house is perfect for people our age. You know, you don't have to climb up, you don't have to climb down. Do you have any smart control electronics in your house? I've been interested in that for years and years and years. Back in the 70s and 80s, I used X10 controllers. I think Radio Shack was even selling them. Then I moved on to Insteon controllers, and they went out of business about 2 years ago, and then some guy bought them up, and it's a hit or miss type of thing. So I'm looking at my third generation of home control electronics. So I've picked out a nice new control hub and Zigbee and Z-Waves, and I'm gonna learn stuff about that and see what I can do with it. I'm just wondering if you have any automated systems in your house.
Have been something, you know, the house was built in the '70s, mid '70s. This house that we're in here, and that's fairly new. My house in Brooklyn was built in 1905, so. This is like modern to me, but there were some weird like buttons that didn't do anything, that old buttons, so it might have been some kind of old automation, and you can see where old panels, wires coming in, and old panels were taken out, and stuff in closets, so there must have been some like that. What kind of controlling were you looking to do with your house now? Lights and thermostats and things and heat, or TVs and stuff like that? Over.
A little bit of everything, really. I don't have central air, so the only thing that the thermostat would be able to do is, you know, turn the heat on or off, and so, you know, I can kind of handle that by myself. I've always had lights that go on and lights that go off, appliances that go on and off, let's see, what else, infrared detectors, so if people are passing by. Contact indicators, if doors open and close, you know, bits and pieces of that. Nowadays, the hubs that control them can be tied into your washer, dryer, all the Internet of Things type of stuff. I also have a weather station out in my backyard. I could wire it that into the hub, supposedly. And so everything that's sort of the Internet of Things can be centrally monitored and controlled on a modern-day hub.
The washer and dryer that's in this house are kind of, well, the washer's kind of new, but the dryer's old. My last house that we lived in Brooklyn, we bought a new matching washer and dryer, GE, because the ones that came with the house were disgusting. And they were enabled to be networked, but we just had no means to network them and no really desire to. But I forgot about that, so you mentioned it. And, that's pretty cool. I'm dying to get a weather station. Do you have any recommendations for a good one? Because I kind of get lost. It's going to take a lot of, a deep dive to hunt, go on the hunt. Maybe you could recommend some models or makes or something. Over.
Yes, I do. I have something called the Tempest Weather Flow. You could just Google it up. It's a very compact. Most of the other weather stations are kind of big and they flap around because the wind has a kind of a fan to it. This is all really tightly built in, and so it looks almost like nothing. And it's a little more expensive than most of the other routine types of weather stations, but check out Tempest Weather Flow.
Very much, I will do. Yeah, definitely, I've been looking into that, but I just couldn't get motivated to do a deep dive on that. Thanks a lot. Back to you.
You're welcome. It's very easy. It has a solar recharging battery to it. It has a wireless connection to its own little hub. You plug the hub into any power supply, and it then connects to your network with the Wi-Fi. And then it's a cloud-based option, so that if unfortunately the company ever goes bankrupt, you're screwed, as most of these cloud-based Internet of Things utilities are. But it's very nice. It can give me a readout. I can dump it out as a comma-separated value file. You know, if I'm crazy and want to know what the temperature and barometric pressure and, lightning and how close the last lightning strike was, it's all available to be downloaded. It's nice.
I'll give a guess when you're going to do it for the puzzle for today. It'll just be a guess, but maybe an educated guess when you're getting around to do it. So just let me know. Over.
Okay, very good. I'll certainly thank you, Joe, for all this participating in the lovely TechNet. Let me ask if anyone has any other questions or comments, and if not, then we'll move on to the TechNet puzzle. Otherwise, we'll go to the questions. So once again, I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If you're interested and have some question or comment to make, please hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign.
Hey Roy, this is Nikita Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Golf Kilo. I was going to ask you about some 2-meter stuff tonight.
Sure, feel free.
Well, I picked up a Radio Shack HTX 10 because I know that we have a 10-meter band net on Sundays. I'm not sure if it's going to get in time to participate, but I definitely am going to try to jump on either the next weekend or weekend afterwards. But I was wondering if there's any special way, because I was going to set up a dipole for that, just like a wire dipole, some AWG. I didn't know if you thought it would be better to like cut that dipole wire to the band itself, or maybe I should just cut the wire to the exact frequency, like down to the centimeter.
Well, I mean, it sort of depends. If you're only interested in using it for the net, then tuning it for the exact length for the net is the most efficient thing. You might want to use it for other things. I haven't had access to my HF radio in a couple of weeks, but I assume the 10 meters is a little sluggish still. A propagation kind of collapsed for some strange reason. I would just kind of cut it generally in the area, someplace close to 28.380, and it doesn't have to be spot on. The question I would have is how do you know when you have it spot on, unless you have a vector network analyzer. You know, if you just kind of measure it for a quarter wavelength on either side, you're not going to get the exact resonance because of something called end effect on either end of the dipole. It has to be ever so slightly longer than a quarter wavelength in length.
And another question I had was, if we, for that net, I see we're going to do upper sideband. Is there a reason that we're doing upper sideband as opposed to lower sideband?
Yes, there's a very good historical reason. I mean, you got to pick one or the other, because you can't really have some people operating on the upper and others on the lower. It leads to a lot of confusion. So everyone kind of came to the conclusion that you had to have a rule. Just so happened in 1950, the radio that started the single sideband off had limitations so that you could only do the lower sideband in single sideband from 40 down, and above it you could only do upper sideband. Nowadays you can do either or, but because of that historical happenstance, everyone got locked in to the rule that if you're doing 40 and below, it's lower sideband. If you're doing above 40, it's upper sideband.
This is Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Golf Kilo. I was just going to ask one more question, and the question is about verticals. Because I've been cutting different dipoles to kind of experiment, but I've also been looking into getting some just like straight up downmast verticals, like getting one that are multi-band, and I'm wondering if you had any experience with working like multi-band verticals.
Well, I personally have not. Usually just a straight vertical and nothing special, is probably, the problem is if you ask the laws of physics to kind of let you get away with too much, that you got to pay back some other way. So there's all kinds of different vertical antennas that are multiband. A lot of them have traps and stubs and all kinds of little tricks to have different modes where they're resonant on. So, there are straight just vertical, nothing special, and your antenna tuner does most of the hard lifting. And the other ones with the traps and the stubs and such, if you tune them right, They work very nicely. So it sort of depends on which vertical, multi-band vertical you're talking about. The problem is monoband antennas are simpler and more efficient. The more and more you get multi-band action out of them, you pay in efficiency in all kinds of things. Also, the radiation angle is kind of wonky when you have more than one band working on an antenna. So, although one frequency can go out nice and clear like a donut, on the harmonics for the multiband, there's all kinds of nodes all over the place. So, you know, if your antenna nodes are in the wrong place at the wrong time, you don't really get good contacts. You need a lot more luck with multiband antennas, vertical and horizontal.
A whip antenna that's like 19.5. It doesn't really do as well, but whenever I've experimented putting a dipole up, I've always gotten great reception and also been able to transmit a lot better as well.
Okay, the part of that was muffled. The strangest things will sometimes work if you have a little bit of luck. I often mention there was a guy who wrote a book on antennas and went into the antenna business, and he kind of wanted to demonstrate that motivation was more important than physics almost. So he took a 100-watt incandescent light bulb, put it on a 5-foot wooden fence post, connected it to his coaxial cable to his transmitter, and ended up getting a worked all states certificate, despite the fact that 100-watt light bulbs are not the best antennas in the world. So, you know, the whips can work if you tune them, either with a loading inductor, a coil, or with an antenna tuner. So, you know, I make a joke that my Palstar, if I had to, I could resonate my doorknob.
I was also wondering, do you think it would be best, because I know the HTX, it goes like 25 watts, and one of the things I'm really scared of, especially in the city, I've been doing a lot of research on that, to modulation, because I've seen that like a lot of channels, depending on how people are using their repeater systems, like with jump channels. So I'm wondering if you think it would be better to try to QRP into the 10-meter single sideband net, or would it be better to just try to give it its full blast, or just like dial back the power?
Well, I mean, the general practice of amateur radio suggests that you use the minimum power necessary to make the contact. Offhand, I'm trying to think if anyone is using... The average guy on the net tends to use a desktop radio that usually is designed to put out 100 watts, and most of them are putting out those 100 watts. I'm using a linear amplifier that puts out 500 watts, so... As long as you have a decent tune, because I don't want you to break your transmitter, I would probably use the whole 25 watts. You know, if you're very close to someone, in the old days, Howard N2GOT, probably about a mile away from me without too many high elevated obstructions, I would put my transmitter connected to my dummy load, and he would do the same, and we would chat back and forth because our dummy loads were leaky enough with something like 100 watts, leaky enough to hear each other. But I think in your case, I would try the 25 watts as long as things are safe, you know, using 25 watts.
This is KTHJ. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Nikita. Thank you for participating. I hope you'll come back and join us in future episodes of our Technical Net. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has any more questions or comments for tonight's net, please hit that push-to-talk button and give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, I guess it's a good time. It's right after 10 o'clock. It's a good time for the TechNet puzzle. There's no pictures. We got a picture for next time puzzle, but no pictures this time. The question is, the simplest piece of equipment that can be used to test for the presence of harmonics in the output of a transmitter is, and it gives you four choices. Choice A is a digital frequency counter. Choice B is an antenna analyzer. Choice C is an analog multimeter. And choice D is an absorption wave meter. So anyone want to hazard a guess?
Roy, I'll guess B, an antenna analyzer.
Okay, thank you, Joe. Anyone else want to hazard a guess tonight? Okay, I guess the kind of quiet crowd. Well, I'm sorry, Joe. An antenna analyzer is a very good, it's basically an impedance analyzer or a device that measures the vector impedances. So it'll tell you the resistance, the reactance, and the angle, the lag or lead of the, you know, the current going through a certain impedance. So it doesn't really give you any frequency detection. Digital frequency counting gives you frequency count, but it gives you the strongest frequency. If you have other frequencies happening on the same signal, it'll be kind of lost in the background, so it wouldn't be digital frequency counter. And an analog multimeter, a voltometer or such, again, just gives you volts and ohms and amps. It doesn't give you frequency. An absorption wave meter, or better known as a grid dip meter, will give you resonances. So if you kind of dial it through and you see where it's giving you these little dips, you can get an idea that there's more than one resonance. So that's the, and those things used to go for cheap. You could probably still pick them up on eBay for about $100, $150, and probably if you bought it new, you consider the inflation rate, it probably would be about the same. Grid dip meters and absorption wave meters were very useful back in the old days. Now you just kind of put a, you know, there's more expensive, more technical stuff that you can use to measure harmonics. You would rather than a digital frequency counter, you would really prefer a spectrum analyzer. That would definitely give you a lovely graphic image. But in the old days, those were very, very expensive, and absorption wave meters were very, very cheap. So the answer is D, an absorption wave meter.
Roy, I didn't know what an absorption wave meter is. I know what a dip meter is. So you're saying the modern replacement would be one of those mini VNAs or something like that that replace the dip meters?
No. A vector network analyzer is only going to give you a reading on impedance. It's not going to display the signal frequency. What you would need is, and they cost about the same. I bought a Chinese spectrum analyzer for about $80. And what that does is give you a graphic representation of RF amplitude versus frequency. So what you would see is hopefully the primary bump, and then you would see the secondary and tertiary harmonic bumps. And that would give you an indication that there's something complicated going on. So it would be a spectrum analyzer that you would use these days. And, you know, like I said, you could pick one up for about $80-$90, as long as you don't need it to work in the gigahertz range.
Thanks, Roy. Yeah, my confusion was I assumed that these other things like analyzer. The things that are dealing with the impedance, I thought would give that graphic that you're talking about with the spectrum analyzer. I thought a VNA was a spectrum analyzer, so I learned a lot there with that. Now, were they, like, say the dip meter and the spectrum analyzer, what, you just plug that into the cable, the 239 connector type thing, right into your antenna cable, or how does that attach to your system? Over.
Okay, that's an interesting point. You don't even need to connect it to anything. It simply can be capacitively coupled to your resonating device, and it will, by coupling to it, it will give you an indication of its resonant frequencies. So it's just a matter of placing it close enough to the antenna or what have you, so that it's capacitively coupled. That's that goes back to, a lot of times people tell each other that you really shouldn't put metal objects next to an antenna, that you should kind of mount the antenna in the position you plan to use it before you test to see whether it's resonant or not, because it's very easy to test an antenna on the ground, but the resonant qualities on the ground where it's coupling to the ground are going to be completely different when they're, say, 20 feet off the ground, where you plan to keep them. So you don't even have to make a physical connection. You just have to put them close enough so that the fields couple.
Roger, Roger. I hope I'm not taking the fun out of the quiz part of the evening, but I'm using it as a learning experience. What was the brand that you bought? I'm going to pick your brain again, because that's like something I think I would like to have, that spectrum analyzer, especially if they're the cheap Chinese. Go back to you, Roy.
Did you hear me when I was answering? Because sometimes this thing doesn't quite trigger.
You, if you even heard my question, or if I dropped out. No, I didn't catch it at all. Could you please repeat that? Thank you. Back to you.
It's just that sometimes hitting the push to talk works, and sometimes hitting the push to talk doesn't quite work on EchoLink here, the way I have it set up. I said that, unfortunately, I do not remember the magic name of the spectrum analyzer. It could be iSpectrum or aSpectrum. What I would suggest you do is just Google Chinese spectrum analyzer. Don't bother with the ones that, you know, are in the hundreds of dollars category of actual professional stuff. Look for something a little bit bigger than the size of a pack of cigarettes. And certainly on eBay, I'm sure there's a whole bunch of different people selling them. Alibaba is probably selling them. Probably Amazon is selling them. It might be a little bit safer to go through Amazon, but, you know, let the buyer beware.
Picking your brain and everything, but I'm, like I said, I'm using this as a learning experience. All right, back to you, Roy. Thanks.
No problem. That's what this net is all about. If you can gain some information, some knowledge, then that's the point. And that's the same thing for the puzzle. The point is not necessarily to get the puzzle right or get the wrong, but to use it as an opportunity to learn some things that the subject brings up. So, this puzzle succeeded tonight. So I thank you for the opportunity to do so.
Very much. You're more than welcome. Back to you.
Very good. One more time. I'm still AC2GS. My name is still Roy. This is still the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're coming probably to the end of the net tonight. But before we say adios, I'll give you all an opportunity. If anyone out there has suddenly come up with a question or a comment that they want to make before we close tonight's episode, then please hit that push to talk and say your piece. Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. And we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be October 4th, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month at 9 p.m. We also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband. Offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. Just point your browser at stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome, but we like it when people join our club, and an application is available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services are generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, 3 Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens, so try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. It's time to roll this all up and shut it all down, but we'll be back again October 11th to do it all over again, and you're welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially my co-host, Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Everyone, have a great week. Be well, and we'll talk to you down the line. This is AC2GS, clear.
N2DEJ, clear, 73, everybody.
Kilo Echo 2, Alpha Golf, Kilo, clear, 73.